Welcome to Ramen Hunter, the podcast where we talk to ramen hunters about their tales in the wild. Today I'm joined by two friends of the pod that I'm very excited about to bring to you. First off, we have the ramen beast, Abram. Welcome to the pod.
Yo, yo, what up? Good to be here, as always.
Thank you very much. And we also have, from New York, the creator of Ramen Shack, Shimamoto Noodles, and the Ramen Burger, got Keizo Shimamoto. Thank you for joining.
Hey, how's it going?
First off, I do have to address, we're recording this off, first off, on December 2nd, and there was a bit of a bombshell IG post from Keizo. So Keizo, can you tell us, what was the big announcement?
Yeah, so I just put on Instagram this morning that I am shutting down my noodle factory this month. And, you know, I'm giving up the space and hopefully do something new.
So it's obviously a tough time for a lot of food service industry businesses. What's this kind of state of food in New York right now with COVID?
Well, yeah, Manhattan is like, it's kind of a sad, I guess, situation right now. We're looking at no tourists in the city, no businesses, a lot of the offices are closed. So the population has drastically dropped. There's not as many people walking around, not as many people dining out. Even the dine-in situation, it's still 25%. And we got outdoor dining now, but the weather is just too cold to even sit outside. Like, not many people have heaters yet. And, you know, it's still kind of rainy and cold. So it's not a good situation.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I know that there were a lot of people who were very excited about Shimamoto Noodles. I hear a lot of the feedback that you get on Instagram. People are very excited to get their hands on any product that you make. So very sad to hear, but I'm sure you'll bounce back with even stronger. So if you can get into it, any thoughts for the future? What's kind of on your to-do list for the future, 2021?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like the restaurant industry is going to have a tough time. For me, doing a ramen shop was not really what I wanted to do. I mean, I love doing it, but it's just really grueling and tough, especially with three small kids. Now, we have homeschooling and stuff, so it's really hard to run a business. So with all that put together, you know, for me, I just want my family to be safe and able to live a normal life as possible. So I don't know. We'll see. It's still kind of my family hasn't left the house, the apartment. We only have a small two-bedroom apartment. So it's you can imagine how it gets so crazy with all of us in here every day, all the tension and the screaming and the fighting. But, you know, we've become a lot closer. I guess from here on out is really just to kind of ride out the wave and then figure out what to do later. Just make sure the family's safe, make sure they're good. And I don't know, try to find different ways to make money or, who knows, start a podcast or something.
There you go. Feel free to take over the Ramen Hunter podcast. I'll step into the sidelines. I'm curious. I'm sure the one thing people definitely want to know is, will you still be doing the kits, or is that also going to go away with Shimamoto?
Yeah, that'll go away too. So no more space to do anything. It's unfortunate, but the past, 6-7 months has just been trying to survive and not really make any money. Landlords have been lenient about paying less rent, but they still want me to pay it eventually. So it's you got this situation where you can't really make as much money as you used to. And then landlords are still expecting to get their money back at a later time. So it's you're digging this hole, right? And accumulating debt. So it feels like it could go on forever. So for me, the decision was, I just need to cut it off. The landlord can take over the space and let someone else rent it from him so he can get money. You know, there's all kinds of obviously more situation, more stuff than that, but that's a big reason.
Well, the ramen world will be bummed, is bummed, but, you know, please take time to get your situation right and bounce back, because we're all looking forward and definitely rooting for you for the next project that's coming down the line. We all are rooting for you, so yeah, good luck.
Yeah, man, 100%.
It's all good. I feel good about it. I'm ready to like do something new rather than just being like that Groundhog Day, same thing every single day, doing like nothing.
Yep, you got the talent. You can do it, my man.
Exactly. No matter what you do, I'm sure people will follow. But I will say this: there's no money in the podcast game, so definitely don't go down this route. Abram, let's switch over to you. So, you know, I know that you also have been involved in the restaurant business in the States. We talked about it a little bit last time, but what's kind of the current update with things with Men's Show San Francisco?
Yeah, it's pretty brutal, man. Our restaurant in San Francisco has been closed since August. I was supposed to go back with Shono this month to reopen and work on our next restaurant, which has been delayed indefinitely. But now, because there's a spike in cases, like California is like on lockdown again. So I have no idea when we're going to be able to go back. It's probably not going to be until next year. So as soon as things get better, basically Shono and I plan to go though. But I just like right now, there's no telling when that could be. I think probably not, like the very soonest would be January, but maybe not till February or March or April. You know, it's like, I have no idea. So we'll see. Like the same thing. We're losing money every month. Our landlord's been super cool. And it's just like, yo, we'll figure it out at some point. But yeah, of course they're going to expect to get paid. Yeah, just like trying to survive until we can open is pretty much how it's going right now. Fingers crossed.
Hope you guys can hold off until things turn the corner. So good luck with that. Well, let's talk about happier things. I don't want to be on this pod. So, you know, I want this to be a celebration of ramen. So one thing I always like to ask, you know, the guests, this is probably more for Abram, is what have you been eating recently? What are some notable bowls in the past week or two that people should know about?
Well, I just got back from Kyushu last week, and I know that the place that you guys are most interested in is Rai Rai. So that was one of the top experiences for sure. And I also ate at this other new spot in Kita, Kyushu, the north side of Kyushu, called Maruken, which has just been open a few months. And those bowls and experiences were just insane. Yeah, I mean, I could tell you like the quick like 2-minute story, or I could tell you like the 30-minute story. But I mean, I don't know how much you want to know, but I mean, both you guys know about Rai Rai, so like that's just an experience.
Well, why don't we get into Rai Rai? Because I know that you talked about that on the, you know, you mentioned as one of your bucket list bowls last time, and you were tried and were denied. So tell us a little bit, tell the listeners about your experience at Rai Rai.
Okay. Yeah. So to summarize real quickly, it's like one of the most desirable ramen shops to go to in Japan amongst ramen heads, because it's only open for like 1 or 2 hours a day at the crack of dawn. There's not much information known about it. Like there's no set hours. Apparently the master only serves like 20 bowls or 30 bowls a day. It's just one of those like places that you make a pilgrimage to, not because you're hungry, just because you want to like check it off the list. So, you know, we got there just after 6:30, and of course there's already like a line, you know, and everyone that goes to eat at this place is not normal. It's like a bunch of freaks, like foodies, Instagrammers. A car, like, you know, like a speeding car swerved over, and this big like fat guy was driving, all sweaty, and he's like, where's the parking lot, you know, like frantic that he's gonna like, this is at like 6:30 in the morning, it's like dark outside, And there's people that are like frantic to like not miss the cutoff so that they can try this bowl. But anyway, the master, so nice and cool and just wants to talk to the customers. So I think what makes this place special is it's not about like how many bowls he can sell. It's about like creating an experience for each diner. So even though there's only 7 seats inside, like when we were in there, he kept 2 open seats the whole time. Even though there's a line of like 10 people outside, it's like he just doesn't give a shit about keeping the place full. What's more important is like being able to like have a cool atmosphere where like everyone is making good conversation. So he's very serious when it comes to the ramen. And yeah, the ramen is delicious, of course, but just like the whole aura and like vibe and process of like waiting and then like talking to the master as you're in there, it's just like a super unique experience that you can't get at any other ramen shop.
Very, very cool. Keizo, I was surprised. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
So, yeah, sorry. No, sorry. Did you have a question for Keizo? Go for it. Keizo, I don't want to talk too much.
I was surprised that you also knew about the shop and you had questions as well. So, you know, what would you like to know about Ibn's experience here?
No, well, just hearing about it, it kind of feels like, you know, how Ramen Shack was. I know you guys never came, but that's kind of like how my shop was. It was a cozy little 10-seater and like I was right in front of everybody able to talk to people. So it's just cool. You know, it's not really for the money. It's just, you know, for the fun of it. So I love to hear how, you know, there's a chef out there that's passionate and just likes to talk about ramen while making it.
Yeah. So I'll tell you a little story that's like so incredible. Because one thing about the master of Rai Rai is he is super, super knowledgeable about ramen in Kyushu. He's been to like every shop. And, you know, obviously a lot of like hardcore ramen heads come there and like know their game. So he was like, as far as like masters go, one of the most knowledgeable masters about ramen shops in Kyushu that I've ever met. So, of course, he's talking to me because he's interested in me. And I'm there with my Japanese like ramen senpai who's from Fukuoka. And they're talking about ramen. And instantly, we kind of had like mutual respect for each other because we kind of agreed on some of the same shops. And then he asks us, he's like, so there's this new shop. I don't know if you guys know about it. It's in like Kita, Kyushu. It's like just across from Shimonoseki, like in the middle of nowhere. It's only been open a few months. I only had the takeout ramen because of Corona. Like they weren't doing dine-in. And this is Rai Rai's master telling us. He's like, it was super awesome. It's called Maruken. And we're like, we don't know about it. We've never heard anything. And the guy sitting 2 seats over, this solo diner, just this old guy who had a mask on, hadn't said one word the whole time we'd been talking about ramen. He's like, oh, that's my shop. So the master was sitting there next to us. So everyone's like, oh my gosh. So anyway, after we eat, we're like, we talk to this guy walking to the parking lot. And he's like, by the way, if you guys want to go to my shop and you want to be in the first seating, you should arrive at like 7 in the morning, which is when we put the list out and customers start writing their names down. And we're like, what time do you open? He's like, 12 o'clock. And we're like, what? He's like, yeah, sorry, I can't talk more. I got to go. Like, my wife is sleeping in the car while he was eating Rai Rai. His wife was sleeping. So funny. But anyway, so we're like, we're researching the shop Maruken. Can't find any information about it. There's like 4 reviews on Tabelog. Super new. We're like, is it worth it? Like, should we wake up at 6 a.m. and drive all the way out there to go to this unknown shop? Screw it. Let's do it. So we drive out there in the morning. We're first and second on the list. So we had like 3 hours to kill. This place is like on the back side of a dried fish and bento box, like it's like business. There's like garbage piled up. It looks like a junkyard almost. And then over to the right of this, of all these piles of trash, are 2 stock pots low to the ground with tonkotsu soup simmering. This was at 7:30 in the morning. So crazy. But anyway, sorry to drag this story on and on. Right before the shop opens, we're waiting and the master comes out and he starts mixing the tonkotsu soup, and he's like, yo, Abram, do you want to like take a mix? And I'm stirring it, and as I'm stirring the soup, I'm like, I can't believe this is going on. I look over, and Rai Rai's master arrives at the shop. He had written his name down, number 3 on the list, and just by chance, we had both gone. So I got to eat lunch next to Rai Rai's master at this shop, Maruken, and it was amazing. The guy is like a tonkotsu guru, this guy, Maruken's master, and he explained to us all about the process of making tonkotsu soup. We got to like sip it in paper cups, like outside the shop before we even went in and sat down. Noodles, like whatever, toppings, whatever. Toppings are self-service. For 200 yen, you can pile on as much chashu and negi and kikurage as you want. But super cool experience. Like the ramen scene in Kyushu is deep. Like they're hardcore about it. And yeah, those 2 days, just eating at Rai Rai and then the next day at Maruken, like just amazing.
Wow, that is an amazing, amazing experience.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of brings us to the topic of this podcast, which is Hakata Tonkotsu Ramen. When I hit Abram up about this podcast, I said, you know, what do you feel about this topic? And he's like, well, I am in Fukuoka right now, so yeah, I'm down. I had no idea. I'm not stalking you or anything. I really didn't know you were there. So, you know, this is fate. And, you know, I really want to bring in Keizo in because this tonkotsu ramen is really technical in terms of, well, at least to me anyways, in terms of how you make it. There's a lot of terms that I don't quite understand. And I need someone who's not just a ramen eater, but a ramen creator to really break down some of the finer points of what goes into this bowl. Because it's not... It's much more tricky than it seems on the surface. And I want people to understand just how deep the bowl they're eating is. So, now first off, what's the literal meaning of tonkotsu? Let's go with the guy with maybe the best Japanese, Keizo. What is the literal meaning of tonkotsu?
Tonkotsu is ton for pig, pork, and kotsu is the bones. So just pork bone soup.
Exactly. So yeah, it's literally the ingredient. It's not... a style per se. Tonkotsu is an ingredient. So if you hear someone say this is a tonkotsu soup, it just means there's pork bones in it. But I'm also curious. I know that tonkotsu seems to be the most popular style in the U.S. if not the world. What is the tonkotsu scene like in the U.S.?
I mean, it's huge. I mean, there's a lot of tonkotsu shops. It's pretty much dominated by tonkotsu, I think. We've seen a change lately. In the past, like, few years, I mean, even with Mencho coming, like, going towards a more Chintan Shoyu type ramen. But tonkotsu is still the dominant type of ramen. Like, even on my menu, whenever I put it on, it's probably, like, number one or number two bestseller.
Nice, nice. And you hinted at it a little bit earlier, like, with places like Mencho coming into the U.S., but... a trend to more of the Chintan soup. Is that all across the board? Do you see that? Like, I know you mentioned, I think it was an interview somewhere where you said New York is very much a tonkotsu town, more so than the West Coast. But you do think that things are getting a little bit more Chintan style?
Yeah, I mean, there are several Chintan, like really good Chintan places popping up. You have like Ishida, Nakamura, like No No No, but those are all good shoyu Chintan shops that can hold their own against the tonkotsu shops. But I think it's still like tonkotsu is that creaminess, that noko, the deep flavor. Like, people just love that, like Americans or anybody.
And when you're serving the bowls, do you like, I'm sure you overhear people talking, or you know, you might even interact with your diners, like you're saying at Ramen Shack. Are there any like common misconceptions about tonkotsu that you hear a lot that you maybe want to correct?
Well, it never stops, but like people always call it tonkatsu. But tonkatsu is different. Like, I mean, I hate talking about that, but people still make that mistake to this day. So like tonkatsu is the fried pork. Tonkotsu is the pork ramen. Other than that, like, I think tonkotsu, I guess like when when Ippudo came to New York and really popularized like Ippudo's tonkotsu, that was the thing to have. Like people think generally like that's the only tonkotsu. I have a funny story where I'm more of a shoyu guy. So when I went to like Wakayama and had Ida Shoten and tonkotsu shoyu, like that kind of blew me away. So for me, like when I put tonkotsu on my menu, it's with a shoyu type and it's more of like that style. Yeah. I had one guy, American, come in, and he asked, like on the menu, I put tonkotsu with shoyu tare. So he asked for a shio tare in the tonkotsu. And I'm like, sorry, no, I don't do that. And he's like, why don't you? That's how tonkotsu is. Like I lived in Nagahama for 10 years, right across from Ganso Nagahama. And they use a shio tare. Why can't you use a shio tare? I was like, who the fuck is this guy? But, you know, I think, yeah.
No soup for
sure
you.
He never came back. but yeah, it's like things like that. Like, you know, tonkotsu, like we're talking about Kyushu tonkotsu today, but tonkotsu has really evolved throughout the south of Japan and up to like Tokyo and the north. So there's still like a lot to talk about within tonkotsu and within the tonkotsu realm.
Definitely, definitely. And I know it's such a big topic. That's why for this podcast, I want to keep it basically to the Hakata Fukuoka area, because that's probably the most influential style overseas. But bringing it back to Japan then, you know, Abram, I know that you have eaten a lot in Kyushu, a lot in Fukuoka, but also a lot outside of Kyushu as well. So outside of Kyushu and outside of Hakata, what type of image does Hakata Tonkotsu Ramen evoke, especially in Tokyo, where we live?
What kind of image? I mean, it's one of the most famous styles of ramen, so I think everyone knows it. And of course, some of the most famous chains that have become extremely successful outside of Japan, like Ichiran and Ippudo, are Hakata style as well. So it's prominent. It's very well known. You know, in Tokyo, like, yeah, there are some famous shops, you know, like everyone knows like Tanaka Shoten, and there are like some other shops that do it well, but it's not Tokyo style. So it's definitely not what Tokyo does best. And, you know, like we can get into the specifics more later, but like, you know, with a lot of these shops in Hakata that have been open like, you know, 50, 60 years, you know, they have like the soup where, you know, they're using some of the mother soup in the next days, or the same thing with the tare sauce. So they've been like developing these flavors for like a long time, and to just like transplant that in a place like Tokyo or another area, it's harder to do at like a super high level. You know, it's easier to do it like on the chain scale. But yeah, like everyone, I think everyone knows Hakata Tonkotsu, and it's like, I don't know, it's like an easy bowl to crush. There's not a lot of crazy toppings. So like it's a popular late night option. I think no matter where you are in Japan, like usually there's a Hakata spot somewhere nearby, and they're usually open at night.
Yeah, we will get into that a little bit later because I have questions about that, you know, because they definitely have different operating hours than your typical ramen shops. And I'm guessing there's a reason for that, but we'll get into that a little bit later. All right, well, let's jump into just kind of the history of tonkotsu ramen just briefly. And this is all half-assed internet research, so don't ever quote Ramen Hunter podcast for historical knowledge, because I'm clearly talking out of my ass. But, you know, started in a place called in Kurume, which is a city just south of Fukuoka, at a place called Nanking Senryo in 1937. Master was originally from Nagasaki, so he decided to use the soup from Nagasaki Champon, which is his hometown, as the inspiration for tonkotsu ramen. At the time, the bowls were or chintan bowls. The concept of a cloudy, milky tonkotsu just didn't exist. But he was buddies with a guy who started a yatai called Sankyu. This was started in 1947 out in Kurume. And one day, as legend goes, he left the shop. The master left the shop and left his mom to look over things. But she let the soup boil too long and it came out cloudy. And rather than just throw the soup out, he tasted it and said, well, maybe I can make this work. So that's kind of how the modern version of tonkotsu was born, according to urban legend. And it kind of spread out from there. He had a couple shops and some of those staff kind of spread out to other parts of Kyushu. And it became a thing, apparently. So especially in the 50s, starting from there. But, you know, we hinted at it a little bit earlier about the complexity of making it. Keizo, you mentioned that you use tonkotsu a little bit. Have you ever made kind of like a Hakata-style tonkotsu before?
Well, Bossa Nova was a Kyushu style. So when I worked in Bossa Nova, Tokyo, they learned from a shop called Shozan in Kitakyushu. So there was pretty legit, like, tonkotsu shikomi, like, prep style. So we had, like, two big kama in the back, like boiling bones at all times. And then we had another egyo pot, with a service pot, where we just keep adding. So that pot would never get empty, would never get cleaned. We just keep adding tonkotsu. So I guess that's the more like traditional way of doing it in Kyushu. But yeah, like, what's it called? Like Tobi Moroshi.
So you're basically, well, let me take a step back. So when researching this topic, I found two terms. One is called Yobi Modoshi. This means where you have one dominant pot and then you're adding to that one constantly over days, weeks, years, even. So that is what's called Yobi Modoshi. And I hear that this is more of a kurume style of making the bowl.
Yeah, I believe Taiho was the first shop that started doing that, I think.
Yes, I believe you're right. Yeah. I saw some place that credited them as coining the term Yobi Modoshi. Yeah. So Taiho is a shop that started in 1950 out in Kurume. Very big shop. They have, I think, up to 12 branches now out there. So a very, very influential shop. And yeah, they're the ones who kind of
Kurume Taiho started the
concept of Yobi Modoshi. And then another term that I saw is called torikiri. And basically, it's your typical ramen where you have a set recipe that you're making every day. And people say that this is more of a Hakata Kyushu style. And I'll be honest, I don't know enough about those two styles to taste the difference. But Keizo, are you familiar with these, the torikiri and Yobi Modoshi?
The Yobi Modoshi, yes. The torikiri, not so much, but I've did some research on it. And I feel like it's more of like a, because of the yatai in Hakata, they can't continuously boil soup at the yatai. So they have to go make it somewhere else. And then that's why, like, they can't do the same Tobi Moroshi, because they have to transport it. And it's also like I think torikiri is more like a Western style way of doing it too. Like a lot of the new school shops, they'll take that approach where, you know, they'll make a batch, they'll store it in the fridge and bring it out for service. Tobi Moroshi, I think it's unique to like tonkotsu in Kyushu. I could be wrong, but that's, you know, my experience with it.
So let's go in a little bit more into the, when you're at Bossa Nova and you're describing the two pots. So what's the process of what goes into each pot?
So at Bossa Nova, we put in like three types of bones. We put the skull, the genkotsu, which is femur, and the backbones. Those three go in, and we basically just boil the heck out of it. And for each batch of bones, we get three batches of soup, which means, so the first set of bones, we put the water in, we boil. Then when it gets to a certain nodo, viscosity, we take it out. Then we add more water, boil the same bones again,
When it gets to a certain nodo, we take it out. And then we do it a third time. But while all this is happening, we have another pot doing the same thing. And we're constantly blending that first boil with the third boil, the second boil with the second boil, the third boil with the first boil, like constantly going just to make it consistent. So that pot up front that we use for service, that's the pot that is going to contain the final soup. And we try to keep that a certain nodo at like 10 or 11. And the way we do that is because that pot is boiling throughout service throughout the day. So it's constantly getting thicker and thicker. So when we put in say it reaches like a 13 or something, and then we want to bring it back to 11, we put in like a 10. So we'll, when the back soup is at a 10, we'll put it in and bring it back down to like 11. So it's like, It's that constant managing of how much soup is going out the door plus how much it's changing by being hot or being kept on the heat, and then how we're adding more to it. So it's kind of like you're always constantly using your brain. It's not a set like, oh, we need to make 20 liters of soup today and then another 20 liters of soup at night or something.
Are you adding bones throughout the process?
No, not this style. We just, that each batch of bones gets 3 soup and then we throw the bones out.
Mm-hmm. And the pig heads you put in whole with the brains inside.
So by the third time that they get boiled, It's just, they're all crushed and, you know, it's easy to burn. So you have to be there mixing it the whole time.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'd always, you know, that method makes the most sense to me, where you start out with the set number of bones, but you see it often in shops where they're like adding bones to the soups, like to the zundo nabe, like during service. Like while there's already soup in there that they're serving. And it's always interesting to see, like, how do they know, like, to, you know, that they're adding the right amount to keep the right balance of the flavors?
Yeah, the crazy style is, you know, the Ieke style. Like, I can't wait till there's a Ramen Hunter podcast on that. But Ieke style, like, it's a tonkotsu, but they're adding raw bones into the service soup and pushing it towards the bottom. So like, so that, you know, you get that namagusaya, that rawness of the soup and the ramen too. And that's what Ieke is. So
I've seen that at Jiro also, like they'll put in like frozen pieces of like skin into the service soup. And then like less than 5 minutes later, they're serving that same soup to like customers. I'm like, dude, there's like raw chunks in there. But
yeah, or they don't know what they're doing. that's half of what ramen is. You make a mistake and you make tonkotsu. I want to get into something though. Like, I guess we don't hear it often in the States at all, but like Kyushu, my friends in Kyushu, they'll come to Tokyo and we'll go eat at a tonkotsu shop and they'll be like, that's not a tonkotsu shop. It doesn't even stink. Like, it needs to stink in order to be like Kyushu style tonkotsu. There's not any shops in America that are like that. Not many in Tokyo either. I mean, I remember Nanden Kanden would like reek, like they'd be like a couple miles away from Bossa Nova, but we would still smell them, you know? So are there still like,
are they reopened, right?
Are there still shops that stink like that same in Tokyo? Or even in Kyushu?
It's a good question. In Kyushu, yes. I mean, Kaidyu is very famous. If you know Kaidyu, they have one in Kita Kyushu and a location near the Fukuoka airport. And that's Yobi Modoshi. Like, the master told me that even when they're closed, they have someone there like stirring the soup because it's been cooking for like 20 or 30 years or something. But from my personal experience, kudume style is more of the stinky, funkier soup. So I think more shops in kudume are like that. in Hakata and like Fukuoka, yeah, you know, I definitely feel like you can smell the tonkotsu. I don't know, maybe you just get used to it over time. But I'm curious myself, like, what creates that smell? Like, is it the Yobi Modoshi soup? Is that it? Because that's Kaidyu. I know. I think another thing about Kaidyu is they don't take the scum out, like the aku that comes to the surface. I think they mix it back in. And I know it's standard in most tonkotsu to like remove the scum. So,
yeah, that's a funny thing.
But I think it can be an issue. No, I was going to say, I think it could be an issue. You know, it's, people are so sensitive, like in Tokyo, where there's a lot of like people in, you know, cramped together. Like if you have a smelly shop, unless it's in the right location, I could see it being an issue.
Well,
with the
that's
neighbors.
Kind of the myth about why the first Nanden Kanden eventually closed down, is because so many neighbors were complaining about it. I mean, but that shop was there for a long time, like 20 years or something. Yeah.
Kanana. You're talking about the one on Kannana.
But
right?
I used to, on my way home from work, like 2 or 3 in the morning, I'd always pass by. And when the shacho was outside, he'd call me in and like we'd have a drink. And I asked him one time, like, what makes it smell so bad? And he wouldn't tell me. But like I've talked to other ramen chefs, and it's basically the funk from around the pots that never get cleaned. And like if you go to those shops and look around the pots and on the ground, it's like there's a lot of funky stuff growing down there. So
yeah you'd get flagged immediately in the States.
Well, actually I have a question about that, Keizo. Is Yobi Modoshi, first off, is that how should I put it, sanitary? Would it pass standards in the States? Would that be possible to create that style?
Probably not. For shops going to Torikiri is because, like, I don't know, it said like a lot of chains transferred over to Torikiri because it's a lot safer and cleaner and healthier. So yeah, I don't think Tobi Moroshi could pass DOH.
Right. And that kind of goes back to Abram's point. You know, you said that there's more funk and smell in Kurume style, and I think that makes sense because that's more of the Yobi Modoshi style. So lots of harusha. It gets more funk on the pots. All right.
Yep.
Interesting. Well, I wanted to touch on something that Keizo was talking about earlier, and you made the point about, you know, Hakata, Kyushu, is very much a yatai or food cart town, and because of that, they have different, you know, kitchen setups. They don't have the luxury of, you know, putting on a pot for days and just using it 24/7. They have limited space and they have to do it in a limited way. So Torikiri is more of the style here. But I want to just kind of quickly let people know a little bit about the history of yatai in Fukuoka. So as I mentioned, they're food carts. These are like the pre-food truck era. This is born out of World War II, typically. I mean, food carts existed before, but they really got popularized in World War II, after World War II, with lots of repatriated soldiers, widows, people lost their businesses, looking to work. It was the lowest barrier to entry. So, yeah, like food trucks. They started to get regulated in the 1950s to address, you know, sanitation concerns. There were about 400 stalls at their peak in Fukuoka along the rivers. Now we have less than 150, and it's kind of shrinking. There's a law in 1994 in that town where it basically barred new yatai from getting a license. So current operators can continue until they retire, but yatais are kind of a dying breed. So it's kind of a shame because it's a big tourist attraction. And they're typically open at night from 6 p.m. to about 6 a.m. That's just a very brief introduction to yatai.
Can I fire some shots here?
Please do.
So all of my Fukuoka local friends say that all yatais now are tourist traps. They say that basically the food isn't high quality. It's the cost performance is bad. And zero people from Fukuoka actually go to them. They're only there for the tourists. So It's like the equivalent of riding the cable car in San Francisco or going to Fisherman's Wharf.
Hey, what are you talking about? That's how I get up the hill.
So, yeah, I mean, go for, if you want. It's, you know, it's the atmosphere. It's kind of cool and you feel like you're doing something cool, like eating outside. But just know that it's not the real legit stuff.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I have been there and I have been to Fukuoka. But when I went, I took a quick peek at the yatai, but it was all tourists lined up. And yeah, I just didn't feel the desire to go. But saying that, a lot of the shops, the OG shops in Fukuoka did have their roots from this. So a lot of these shops eventually would, you know, if they could afford it or if they wanted to, they would, you know, set up a permanent spot somewhere and then grew from there. So, but yeah, it was a, that was a root, the roots for a lot of the shops out there, even in Kurume as well. So it is an important thing, part of Fukuoka history. So if you are in the town, you know, check it out. Grab a drink, but
it's important to know that a lot of famous shops that have been open for like decades in Kyushu started out as yatai.
Time I think yatai, especially in the, you know, 40s were popping up here and there, with a lot of them had a clear chintan tonkotsu soup. According to one story that I've heard, in the late 40s the future founders of Akanoren and a place called Hakuryuken created the kind of a modernish tonkotsu bowl with the cloudy soup and flat thin noodles. Abram, I know that you've been to Akanoren and Hakuryuken. What were your takeaways from these two shops?
Yeah, I mean, both kind of old school. Akanoren is kind of like your typical picture perfect bowl of Hakata tonkotsu. They have a branch in Tokyo near Roppongi, but the head shop is like in central Hakata. I wouldn't say it's any different from a lot of the other like prominent bowls, like well-known bowls in central Fukuoka, but it's definitely worth checking out. Hakuryuken has more of an old school feel to it. That shop has been around for 70 years. It's in I believe is at Higashiku. It's like a little bit outside of central Fukuoka near the university. And the noodles there are flat, which are different from your more traditional Hakata style noodles. And yeah, that shop again, it's like, I wouldn't say it's like it's a mind blowing bowl, but that like the history, you can really feel the history in the place. So definitely a cool shop to check out.
When you're at Hakuryuken, did you see all the sumo handprints?
Yeah. And I didn't understand. There were pictures of sumo wrestlers on the wall. There were a bunch of like, you know, in Japan, they have celebrities autograph those like square cardboard pieces. I don't know what they call those, but there was a bunch of that stuff. So it seemed like a lot of celebs and a lot of sumo wrestlers had been there. Do you know what the connection is to the sumo?
Not offhand. When I went there, I just noticed that too. I was like, wow, okay. So
I did one other side note. I asked, you know, I was talking to, it was like, you know, an elderly woman, and it looked like, I don't know, her husband maybe was cooking the ramen. And I was like, oh, like Sandai Mei, like, are you third generation? And she's like, no, he's fourth generation. And he was like pretty old. So if he's almost done, that means fifth generation could be taking over soon. That's pretty impressive for a ramen shop in Japan to be fourth, fifth generation. Almost unheard of.
It is. Yeah, as you say, it's not going to maybe current standards, it might not blow your socks off, but they were one of the OGs of a pioneering kind of Hakata ramen. And when I went there, this is kind of what I was hinting about with the image of Hakata ramen in Tokyo. Actually, you know, Hakata ramen is actually flat noodles. When I ate it, I thought, wow, it's like, it's kind of like the flat noodles from those instant cup noodles, kind of. It seems like that's what influenced those cup noodles. That was my takeaway. I was really intrigued. And the reason I say that is because it seems like outside of Kyushu, everyone thinks of Hakata ramen as Nagahama ramen. And this is something that I want to kind of highlight the differences between these two. So Nagahama, first off, Nagahama is in a part of Fukuoka that has a fish market, kind of like the Kyushu version of Tsukiji. It's the Fukuoka City Central Wholesale Market. And they moved to Nagahama in 1955-ish. And at the time, there were a lot of ramen shops or yatai that catered to the workers here. And they created a style that was smaller servings of thin, hard noodles that were faster to cook. Because, you know, these guys were at the tuna auctions or whatever, and they went between tuna auctions, they would want to run out and grab a quick bite and then run back to work. So, you know, they also had the kaidama style, where if you want to get extra noodles, you can always order that. So it's small servings of noodles, but you can always get more as you go. And things like toppings like benishouga and sesame and extra tata at the tables. So it's kind of a little bit different. And when you think of a lot of tonkotsu ramen shops outside of Kyushu, oftentimes the noodles are Nagahama style. But am I wrong, or am I just talking out of my ass?
No, I mean, you might be right. I mean, I don't know, maybe Keizo knows more than both of us, but I just kind of figure that they can be intercrossed. When I think of like ramen in Kyushu and Hakata, there's like Nagahama style, there's Hakata style. You know, some people say there's Fukuoka style, which is like a little bit different. And I don't know, in ramen, I don't feel like there's like always like one set way you like have to do it like this, you know, like you can intercross noodles or, you know, techniques. So yeah, maybe you're right as far as like the proper history, but I wouldn't say it's like decided like 100%. This is like how it has to be done. But I don't know. Keizo, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think Nagahama, yeah, it's the thin noodle and, you know, smaller portion. Like, I remember going to like Gansan Nagahama and people would order like 5-6 kaidama because it's really so small. And Hakata is similar, I think. But if you go to like Kumamoto and Kurume, it's slightly different style of noodle. If you go to Miyazaki, it's even more different, I guess. I don't know. It's hard. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, just to confirm, outside of Nagahama style, do other shops offer kaidama?
Yeah, a lot of Hakata style shops do.
So the Hakata style shops are here. They were also.
I mean, what do you consider like Ichiran? Isn't that Hakata style ramen?
So yeah, that's another point that I wanted to touch on.
I mean, yeah. Right?
Yeah. So. I guess, you know, the way that it's evolved outside of, you know, when you talk to people about Tokyo ramen, for example, there's, if you get to a really nerdy guy, you might say, yeah, there's the Ogikubo style with the niboshi. There's the 100% chicken style. There's the, you know, different takes on it. So if you really dig into the weeds, then people can kind of start trying to classify everything and putting it in a box. And obviously you can't really do that. But when you have shops like a big chain like Ichiran or Nippudo who kind of take the Hakata name and go outside, I'm not saying they dumb it down, but they got to make it marketable. And I think that they took kind of the best elements of Hakata and put it into something that they felt was a marketable bowl, which obviously was. So it seems to me like there's a mashup of different styles. It seems like the Nagahama noodles are the ones that kind of dominated outside of Kyushu. And became the representative of Hakata ramen. And as far as the Yobimoloshi or Kiri Tori, probably from a practical point of view, probably Kiri Tori became the dominant style of creating soup.
Yep.
So, yeah. Just,
On talking, if I can shed a little light on the history of Nagahama style and the shop that started it, Nagahamaya. Because like you said, that shop was located in the market and then moved like right nearby the market, Gansan Nagahamaya. And then there was an issue because either like apprentices or people that worked there opened up shops nearby called Nagahama K. And there's kind of like this argument now over like which one is the most legit, which one's the authentic one. And a lot of people say you should go to the original Gansan Nagahamaya and not the two other ones, which are called Nagahama K. There's one that's like just a couple minute walk from Nagahamaya, and then there's one which is in Nakasu. And again, gathering intel from my friends who are Fukuoka locals, they say that, of course, Nagahamaya, the OG spot, used to be the best one. But after the OG master passed away, I forget his name, like Sakakibara-san, I think. Anyway, when he passed away, he said that that shop started making subtle changes to become more business oriented, such as they started watering down the soup a little bit more, and that that place is such an attraction that the soup is really not the same as what it once was when the OG master was there, and that the Nagahama K branch nearest to that shop is run now by an apprentice of the OG master. The other Nagahama K shop in Nakasu is like a ripoff. But if you go to the Ganso Nagahama K shop near Nagahamaya, it's the only shop out of the three that when you walk in, the staff immediately say to you, "Men no kata sa doushimasu ka?" Basically, like, how firm do you want your noodles cooked? Like, they don't even wait for you to order. The other shops, they'll wait for you to actually like order ramen, but they just immediately ask you, like, how do you want your noodles cooked? And you get your bowl within like 30 seconds of sitting down usually. So anyway, if there was any dispute over that.
So what did you answer?
My answer? Yeah, I go katame. Yeah.
So yeah, yeah. How to order Nagahama style is pretty interesting. So as Abram mentioned, this particular shop, if you, as soon as you walk to the door, you got to shout out your order. So how do you order? So there's a list of, and this is specifically for how do you want your noodles? And they have like normal, they have, hard, katame, and they have even other styles like barikata. Do you want it like needle-like noodles or like really hard noodles? Or do you want like kona otoshi? Do you want to just wash off the excess flour and then serve it to you? So it's going to be like almost, so there's levels to it.
It's in the boiling water for like 5 seconds.
Not even. Yeah. So at Bossa Nova, we did that too. So our regular noodle was 10 seconds. And katame was like 5 seconds. Barikata was like 3 seconds. And kona otoshi was basically like half a second. You just get it wet.
You just dip it.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't even remember you guys serving Hakata style tonkotsu at Bossa Nova. Am I tripping?
Yeah, well, it was more Kita Kyushu style, the tondaku soba.
Because I remember every time I would just go for either the green curry or the skamen. Yeah.
So the namesake bowl was tondaku warashi, the double soup, but the tondaku soba was the original recipe from Kita Kyushu when Bossa Nova was in Harajuku, and they were called Basaraka. They only serve the tondaku soba, the tonkotsu.
Damn. I haven't been there in so long.
Yeah, I've only had the curry myself, so.
It fell off after Keizo left. just being real.
Changed owner. So, I mean, that shop had changed managers for maybe like 5 or 6 times since it was there, so a lot of the recipes got like really messed up.
Well, I think that'll happen when the main engine of the shop kind of steps away, so that is a shame. Well, one thing I also want to touch on is how did Hakata tonkotsu style, how did it blow up and spread? Because like when you think of tonkotsu ramen, almost everyone thinks of Fukuoka. I was just doing some research on my own and just kind of dug around. And, you know, Abram or Keza, feel free to jump in and let me know if I'm wrong. But it seemed like the Tokyo boom, anyway, started with Akanoren and Nanden Kanden. Akanoren came in 1978 in nearby Roppongi. And they were, I think, the first legit Hakata-style shop in Tokyo. But it also seems like Nanden Kanden, which you guys have been to, started in 1987. And they really took off, and they had that whole stinky tonkotsu style that was kind of a love-hate relationship that lines out the door. and became a phenomenon, but also really stunk up the neighborhood too. Is my research accurate, or was there any other shops that also contributed early on?
I mean, for me, that's pretty accurate. That's what I've heard, like living in Japan and especially like working around that area. Like Kannanazoe was like gekisenku for ramen shops. And like all the ramen shops, all the popular ramen shops were on Kannana because that was the main road for all the truckers and everybody that went around Tokyo. So that era was just like a special time where even like tonkotsu, like nanden kanden, would get huge lines out the door. But then you have all those other shops too, like in that Kannana area, that would just get crazy busy. It was before like that official ramen boom of the 90s, but you know, it was like the pre-boom where ramen was just like not that great. It was just like really junk, but really popular.
Nice. Yeah. I think Abram mentioned that Nanden Kanden is still around, actually, in kind of a different format, I guess. Abram, I've only been to the newest spot. How has it
been? The one in Koenji?
The one in Shibuya.
Nanden Kanden?
Yeah, they closed the Koenji shop and they moved to Shibuya.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so they're in the Niku Yokocho in Shibuya, which is a kind of a tourist trap. But
By the way, my headphones just died on me, so I'm just using the speaker on my computer. I don't know if it...
Yeah, it sounds fine. It sounds fine.
Okay, great. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, so the newest shop, the newest iteration of Nanden Kanden is in Shibuya in the Niku Yokocho. And the owner, I don't know his name, but he was there hanging out, just chatting it up with customers.
Kohara-san.
But I would imagine it's not so different from the Koenji version. But let's go with Koenji versus the original spot. Abram, did you have any takeaways?
It was crap. It was garbage. I don't know, to break it down simply, there's business ramen and then there's real ramen where like the person making it has passion. And the spot in Koenji was 100% just business ramen. You know, it just felt like a chain, you know? So the fact that you said you were talking it up with the master in Shibuya, that's like, you know, that's kind of inspiring. Maybe
he was not in the kitchen.
No, he does not make.
No, he wasn't. Okay.
So do you know the history about him? He was like a talent.
He was a
big time celebrity. So that plays a part in the whole popularity thing too. Because once you get attached to the Japanese media, the media just go crazy with it. So like even if tonkotsu wasn't that good at that time, like tonkotsu was the thing, so everybody went to get tonkotsu. Just like everyone, you know, gives out chocolate on Valentine's, like the whole March Valentine's.
Yes,
whatever.
Nanden Kanden
I don't want to get into that.
The story of Nanden Kanden is pretty crazy. The shop was like a crazy, crazy, crazy and popular shop in the 90s. Then kind of faded in 2000s, and then eventually I think he went bankrupt, and then kind of ended up as a cautionary tale, and you'd see him up on different TV shows saying, this is an example of what not to do with your life. It's kind of depressing to watch. And then shortly after that, he kind of, took that TV buzz and started up the Koenji shop.
This goes kind of in hand with the story of all the ramen shops that used to be on Kannanadori, because when Nanden Kanden was at its height, it was on Kannana, which was like one of the peak locations in Tokyo for ramen shops, especially shops at night, because it was where all the taxi drivers, this is like, for people that don't know, this is like one of the main roads that kind of makes like a big circle around Tokyo. And then a few things happened. They changed the law so that I believe you couldn't park on the side anymore. And then they also, you know, like the subways got better, and then they built that highway that went underground. So all these things combined, all these shops that were like famous, legendary shops that were open for like decades, just kind of like went out of business. Yeah. And Nanden Kanden was one of them. So there was a time when it was super famous, but yeah, not anymore.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like the pre-ramen boom, the Kannana Gekisenku boom was during that time. And yeah, I heard stories too. Like they started enforcing the double parking by truckers on Kannana.
Yeah.
And that just killed it.
I think that was the main one. Yeah. For all the taxi drivers, I guess truckers too. Yeah. Because there were so many shops along that road that people would hit up.
So even when I was in Tokyo and I'd go around these different Kannana shops, they all installed like these security cameras that would look out and all these TV monitors by the counter. So like when someone would spot like the ticket guys coming, like they'll be like, oh, go out. Is that your car? like Kusamura in Honancho, they do that all the time. The head chef is just staring at the monitor while making ramen. He's like, oi, omae no kuruma da yo, that's your car. So.
Yo, quick side note, that shop Kusamura is so legendary. Everyone should go to that shop once. It's so awesome and so unknown. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite shops. Like, I know E.T.
Gyoza, Epic Gyoza.
E.T. is one of my favorite shops, but yeah, Kusamura is like, you know, my hidden spot right there. The bush, call it the bush.
Well, and I think, doesn't E.T. get their noodles from like Kusamura Seimen? There's like a relationship between the two shops, right? Well,
okay, so this is funny. I was in Kusamura once, and there used to be a shop down the street that was Nakamura, which is now the Bonito, whatever.
Nike.
But Nakamura Tencho was inside talking to the Kusamura guy and asking about, oh, are you related to the Eifukucho Shacho? And he's like, no, we're not related. But there is a connection because the Eifukucho Taishoken founder is Kusamura-san. So Kusamura-san opened up Kusamura Shoten for the noodles. So Kusamura Shoten supplies Kusamura, the ramen shop. And supposedly, like, he named it Kusamura because it was just in honor of him. I guess he might have learned how to make ramen from him. But it's fairly different from E.T. in a sense.
Yeah. It's a very different style, but both the shops opened like within 5 years of each other, I think.
Yeah. And like, well, that area is like, that E.T. influence in that area is pretty crazy because like you had Daitabashi Taishoken, which was Kusamura, his brother, E.T. Kusamura's brother opened that. That unfortunately closed when I was still living there, which was kind of sad.
I remember that shop.
For the listeners out there, E.T. stands for Eifukucho Taishoken.
Yeah.
And this is the shop that Keizo goes immediately to every time he arrives in Japan.
Yeah, it's like home, man. Like, I go there and they recognize me. Like, it's awesome.
There you go. Keizo is famous. Nice. Yeah.
All right. Anyway, let's get back to Tonkotsu.
One thing I want to touch on that you guys kind of hinted at is the hours of for Tonkotsu ramen shops. So this is very different from your typical, let's say, a Tokyo Shoyu shop or something like that. They're typically open longer with little breaks in between, with no break in between. Keizo, from an operation point of view, is there a special reason for that? Or even why that's possible?
Well, I guess because they're constantly boiling tonkotsu. I don't know. It might be, it has to go back to like a Hakata thing, like being late night ramen. Like Tanaka Shoten is open till what? Like 4 a.m, right?
Pretty late, yeah.
I think it's just,
it's
just
late.
One of those things. I don't know.
Is it, for example,
I have a theory. I think with Hakata-style tonkotsu and Kyushu-style tonkotsu, there's so much emphasis on the soup that when it comes to the operation, usually the noodles and the toppings are almost like afterthought that can be like kind of thrown onto the bowl so quickly. So I don't know. I think when it comes down to not only the operation, but also like people eating it, it's just like, it's such an easy bowl to crush. Like, you know, like if you don't order Kaidama, you could probably crush like 3 or 4 bowls of Hakata Tonkotsu back to back to back to back. because it's also a bowl. You're not really expected to drink all the soup.
No, you don't drink all the soup.
So I don't know.
Blasphemy.
Well, sometimes I do. Sometimes I do. But you know what I mean, though. It's not like expected with these richer tonkotsu bowls. I'd say less than half of the customers are finishing all the soup. You know, so I don't know. It's just like the whole process of it is quick and convenient and easy, and it's just like I don't know. It just makes like a good nightcap. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. You know, my personal theory was, especially for the Yobi Moroshi shops, it's easier to keep the soup at a stable level so that you can serve it all day long. I know some other shops for other styles, maybe if they're boiling a pot, you know, the water evaporates, you know, throughout the day. So then the soup gets thicker. So they'll kind of close it in between lunch and dinner and then kind of have a, either tune the bowl or just go in a completely different direction and serve a thicker bowl in the evenings. So it seems like you can avoid that with the Yobi Moroshi cooking method.
I have a theory.
Shoot.
Tonkotsu ramen chefs are just beasts. They just want to work.
That's probably true too.
Everyone else just wussies. Yeah. No, just kidding.
Well, I will say this though: there aren't a whole lot of true hardcore tonkotsu shops that do the Yobi Moroshi or at least outside of Kyushu. It's, as you say, it's hard work, and also it creates a lot of waste. I'm curious, when you were at Basanovo, how did you guys get rid of the bones? Just throw it out in the garbage, or was there a special vendor that came around?
Okay. Well, I mean, it goes out with the namagomi, the ramen.
Okay.
There's so much waste at ramen shops as far as like leftover matter from making like soup or whatnot. Like the namagomi there's a lot. It's a lot of leftover.
Getting stuff into that, like just thinking about stuff like that, it makes you kind of sad. I don't want the environmentalists to get on us, but you know, it's definitely not the cleanest type of restaurant. If you know what I'm saying.
I was watching this one kind of news show, and they were featuring this vendor who went around, this was a couple years ago. His business was going around and collecting bones from ramen shops, especially like Yeke or Tonko or those type of shops. And he had a processing plant to turn it into fertilizer.
Compost. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So there are ways to eco-friendly ways to get rid of your namagomi.
I think more stuff like this needs to happen.
So, you know, I tried to do that in New York because New York is big on compost for the past like few years. There's like household compost bins everywhere. So in Queensbridge, where Ramen Shack was, there's like a compost by the New York Sanitation District. There's like a compost area. They actually came in to eat one time and I said, hey, you know, can I bring my bones to you to like compost? And they were like, well, we're only allowed to take household waste. We can't take commercial waste. So it's that disconnection that, you know, we haven't figured out yet within the business to really make it environmentally, sound or whatever. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, that could be the next big thing. Figure out how to make commercial waste into fertilizer or something useful. All right. Well, I want to go back to kind of how Hakata Tonkotsu blew up and spread. And I think two shops we need to mention, you know, kind of that deserve to be mentioned are Ichiran and Ippudo. So I think everyone outside Japan, when they think of Tonkotsu, they think of one of these two shops or both. So, you know, just briefly touching on their background. So Ichiran, as far as I understand, started off as a yatai, again, in the 1960s. And they kind of introduced togarashi into the tare. So that was a little bit of a different touch. And they moved around a little bit. But in 1990, the original owner was elderly. So I believe he sold it off. And the current owner, I think, relaunched it in 1993 in its present format with, you know, writing the orders, the private counters, And now they're up to 86 branches all across Japan, and I'm sure some overseas. I don't know exactly. So that was Ichiran. Ippudo started in 1985, and again, they grew quite quickly, and they're up to about 125 branches. They're one of the original members of the Shin Yokohama Ramen Museum, and they're actually publicly traded, so you know they're full-on corporate. So I think you know we can't do a podcast about this topic without mentioning these two companies. Takeso, are the I've been away from the States for so long. Ichiran and Ippudo, I understand they're both in the States, right?
Yeah, Ichiran just recently built a big footprint in New York, and they're before COVID, they're getting ready for like mass expansion, I think. But yeah, Ippudo came in, I want to say 2008. Probably have to check that date. But when Ippudo came over, New York ramen kind of shot up and was like the talking point everywhere. They kind of changed the game because they went from not only a small ramen shop, but into a full ramen restaurant with drinks and appetizers. And, you know, they were, it was just a different animal, a different beast.
So they had a game plan, like a proper game plan about how to approach this market and do, and kind of tailor to local needs.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. And then we talked about
that got famous in Japan because of that, you know, like it was the first time that a Japanese ramen shop had done that kind of venture and gone so large scale overseas and really pull it off successfully. Cause not to talk about it too much, but like, you know, ramen is so difficult to make and there's so much that goes into it, yet it's, that you sell it for so cheap, you know, they really went all out with the full izakaya experience and like the sake and all the appetizers. So really they created more than just a ramen shop.
So they created a dining experience, or they reinvented the ramen experience. Sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, they screwed it up for everybody. No, I'm just kidding. Now Americans just want to sit there and drink and eat ramen last.
Ramen has become the shime.
That's a challenge. It's like you want to keep it authentic, you know, like you want to keep it like the, like real, but you have to kind of like cater to local customs and like what people actually want, you know? So it's a constant struggle. Like, at least in my experience, I'm sure Keizo, you probably have a lot of stories you could share, but
yeah, it's a struggle.
Like doing what you really want to do and serving what you really want to serve, but at the same time creating a successful business.
Yeah. It's like that you feel comfortable with, you know?
Yeah.
I think a lot of these chains have come to America and they have that business model where they're importing a lot of ingredients already. So not much prep is done here. Like, the tare, the shoyu, the noodles even. So it makes it easier for them to come and conquer over here, which is good. And it's kind of bad in a sense for as far as like the local ramen shops, like the local ingredient ramen shops that want to kind of make that gotochi ramen, the regional ramen themselves, if it gives an unfair advantage if, like, you know, they're importing this secret ingredient from Japan directly that only Ippudo can use or something. It's really tough to, and then they keep it more consistent, so people love consistency. Even if it's not that great, if it's not that great all the time, you know, you want to go back.
Yeah,
it's a tough line to walk, definitely. You can't hate on it for, you know, it's a style that's worked. It's a business model that works. You know, as Abram hinted, you know, some ramen shops are about the business, some ramen shops are about the kodawari. You know, there hopefully there's room for both. But yeah, it's always going to be a
in Japan there is, but overseas is where it's a lot harder. You know, you really have to think only about the business.
Yeah, it's a different market, definitely. So different realities.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in New York City or even like Tokyo, like Shinjuku or Shibuya, if you have like 10,000, 15,000 people walking by your door every single day, then you want to try and get as many people as you can in. Like New York shops, whether it's ramen or whether it's a burger shop, whether it's like sushi, and you're in downtown, like midtown Manhattan with hundreds of thousands of people every day, like you want to sell as much as you can. That's your money. That's your revenue, that potential revenue there. So you see a lot of chain shops becoming more so like cookie cutter stuff. That's not really great food, but people buy it. So that's the challenge of being in a big city, doing what I like to do. Like I've run into it several times when I opened my shop in downtown called Ramen Co. I had to make some tough decisions too, because we would sell like 200-300 bowls in a 2-hour span for lunch. And to keep up with that was grueling. Like I only had like 2 stockpot burners and it was tough, man.
Man, the struggle is real. The grind is real. But hopefully you can take some time to recharge and decide what you want to do for your next step. Either way, we're looking forward to the next project.
Yep.
One question I have, you know, because I don't really eat ramen in the States. A lot, you know, are they legit? And if so, what do they do? What are they doing right? And if not, what's the gap?
Oh man, that's a tough question. Hakata tonkotsu. I mean, what is Hakata tonkotsu anyway? I think in the States it's hard, because if you go to Hakata, one of the main ingredients is MSG, and it's not frowned upon. You ask somebody like what their favorite ramen shop is, and like, oh, that shop over there uses a lot of MSG. It's really good. You know, so Kyushu people really love their MSG.
Yes.
Americans, you know, you have that debate on if it's unhealthy or not or whatever. I mean, I tend not to use it, but I'm not against it. In America, like a true Hakata ramen shop is very hard to come by, because there's no one really dedicated to making the soup like Hakata style or Kyushu style, like the Yobimodoshi. A lot of these places are buying pre-made frozen stock and, you know, blending it with some other bones and then calling it Hakata Kyushu just because it's a cloudy tonkotsu with thin noodles. So it's tough. There's not really, like, I don't know, like Ippudo, when they first came, they were really doing a good job. But obviously, it takes a toll in trying to run a business and keep the quality up when you're so popular. Ichiran is kind of the same, I guess. Ichiran, I don't know. For me, even Ichiran in Tokyo, it just tastes really manufactured. But when you crave Ichiran, like, you know, that's one of the best bowls to eat. But I don't know. It's hard to say if Hakata tonkotsu ramen in America is authentic.
I think you brought up a really important point, is that most of them have to rely on gyomyo soup or the pre-made soups, and maybe kind of tailored a little bit from there. But for the most part, that seems really hard to duplicate, the yobimodoshi style, you know, probably just for various reasons. So I think from that, just that alone, that kind of makes things really difficult to create a really fresh and interesting bowl.
I would say, though, in New York, if you want to think of a shop that's kind of doing it more authentic, I would say Minka is that shop. I mean, Minka gets a bad rap sometimes, but Minka is based upon Keika ramen. Do you know Keika ramen?
Yeah. Keika is Kumamoto style.
Yeah, so the owner of Minka, he fell in love with Keika ramen, so he wanted to bring that style here. So people, it's a tonkotsu. You go to Minka, it smells like a tonkotsu shop, and you know they're making.
I think I've been there. That's one of the oldest ramen shops in New York, right?
Yeah, it's like 2003, I think.
So you got the fried garlic and everything?
Yeah. And it's got the hard-boiled ajitama, and people will be like, what's up with this? But, you know, that's like the Keika signature.
It is. Yeah.
On top.
That's another pet peeve when people get angry about like a hard-boiled egg.
Like, yeah, the whole half-boiled egg is a new concept, relatively new concept.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I like it. But, the hard-boiled egg, that's part of the reason why I didn't really fall in love with ramen when I was a kid. But, you know, it's not for everybody.
I think what's cool about ramen, though, is, like, you don't have to complain about these things, really. I mean, you go to a shop, and it's really the expression of that chef, of that style. And if you go in with a mindset of, oh, man, it's not hanjuku, and, oh, it's not thick noodles, it's thin noodles, I hate thin noodles, like, you're never going to like what you get. So like wherever you go, I mean, ramen is that kind of food. You kind of, you dive your soul into the chef's soul, and you get to experience that style as something new to you. And then you take away different things from it.
Absolutely. When people ask me what my favorite ramen is, I don't really have one, because I want to eat whatever that master feels is his or her best bowl. And when you eat that, you really feel a lot about what influenced them and what motivates them. And when you don't feel that, then you know the guy just, it's a business bowl of ramen.
Yeah.
This is why, again, it's so difficult to do ramen successfully overseas, because there's not many people that can actually be in the kitchen at all times with that passion, you know?
Yeah. I mean, from the customer side too, I mean, it's a very emotional experience. Like, even if I say my favorite bowl is ET, and you don't agree with that, it's like, you don't have the same experience I have with ET. Like, if I grew up, have this like childhood favorite ramen shop that just brings back all these memories, it might not be that good, but just that experience I have around it, like, brings me back to a time where, you know, it was all innocence. Then, you know, that's my thing. So that's what's great about ramen. I mean, food in general, of course, but yeah, ramen is just something more magical.
We are getting pretty philosophical here. So let's bring it back and just kind of wrap things up in terms of Hakata ramen. So, you know, maybe Abram, for people in Tokyo area, where do you think they should go for an authentic experience in terms of, if they can't get to Hakata?
In Tokyo?
Yeah, or around Tokyo.
So we already mentioned it, but one of like the pillars of the Tokyo scene is Tanaka Shoten. And I believe it's Katsushikaku. I don't know. It's deep.
I haven't been, actually.
And there's another, my favorite Hakata style bowl in Tokyo. I prefer this one over Tanaka Shoten, but they're very, very similar. It's called Ikki, IKKI. And that's another shop that's like deep Katsushikaku, like out in the middle of nowhere. Ikki, more centrally located, like Barikote is a good option, like Nakano Koenji area. There's a shop in central Tokyo, I think, like Ichigaya, Itabashi area, called Hakata Ramen Center, I believe.
Oh, yes, I've heard of it.
I haven't been there in a while, though. Otherwise, I don't know. To be honest, like, what I just said are like some good starting blocks, but I wouldn't like highly, highly recommend any other Hakata ramen outside of Kyushu. Gotaru is a decent shop. That's on, I think, Numabukuro. Gotaru. But yeah, like, Kyushu is really where it's at. Like, I tell people, by far, Tokyo is the best city in the world for ramen because you have everything, you know? But, like, if you want to get deep into, like, Hakata-style ramen, like, you have to go to Kyushu. Like, just because, like I said, there are shops that have been open, like, 50, 60 years where they're using the same tare, you know, like the motodare. And, like, just the experiences and the amount of MSG you can experience in Kyushu is unparalleled. Healthy.
There you go. There you go. Shoot up your veins with all that MSG.
No, when I went to Hakata, I got in a taxi and I said, take me to the best ramen shop around here. And he took me to, I don't know, one of the Nagahama tonkotsu places. And it's like, Ajinomoto tappuri de oishii. A lot of MSG and it's so good.
Yeah, some of those shops after, like, you're walking away and, like, my tongue will be, like, tingling, you know, like, from the MSG. It's awesome.
The Hakata experience. There you have it. Yep. In the States, kids, are any shops that you can recommend?
For
that come close.
You have the Ippudo Ichiran. West Coast, you have Shinsen Gumi. When Shinsen Gumi first came out in LA, like, they're pretty close to a good Kyushu Hakata style. I don't know about now. I haven't been back in so long. Otherwise, not much. There was.
Have you been to that shop, Venice Ramen? I don't. It's not Hakata style, but it's tonkotsu, and I thought that one was pretty damn good. Similar to Hakata style, but I feel like it was slightly. Yeah,
I heard Venice is good. I forget what shop that master trained at, but it's a pretty famous shop.
Yeah, they have, I believe, two shops in Tokyo. One's in Shibuya called, I think, is it Shibuhide? Is that it?
Ah, okay.
And they have another one near Kyoto Station. I've been to the head shop is near Kyoto on the Odaku line. I think it's called Shibuhide.
Yeah, I've been to the Shibuya one. It is Shibuhide.
The Kyoto one? But where Ivan Ramen Plus used to be, like down a little bit down, I think I know what you're talking about. That tonkotsu shop.
Yeah, I can't remember where it is exactly in Kyoto, but
so they're in California? Oh, they have a branch in California?
Yeah, they have a branch in Venice called Venice Ramen. That's like it's one of the better ramen shops I've had in Southern California as far as like authenticity. Like Japanese could go there and be satisfied. Mm. I always use that scale.
There's another ramen shop in New York called Mentoku, which I don't think they're operating right now, but they were based upon Akanoden. So it was franchise Akanoden. They changed the name to Mentoku. And it was pretty close to what you could get in Roppongi.
There you go. The Roppongi experience in New York. All right. Well, sounds like we have some good options for people, you know, living in different parts of the world to try something close to the real thing. Of course, when the world gets back to normal, by all means, check out Fukuoka and the legit Hakata ramen experience. But so, yeah, let's wrap things up here. Abram, any upcoming things that you want to promote? Anything that people should know about?
Just long hours spent in quarantine. Alone in my thoughts.
No kids.
I'm just eating ramen until this pandemic situation gets better. So working on various projects.
Cool. We'll be looking forward to it.
For my new life.
All right. Kaza, how about yourself? I know that maybe it's time to reset and think about things, but anything you want people to know about?
Follow me on Go Ramen Instagram. I might start blogging again if I get the chance, either goramen.com or theramendream.com. So just kind of look out there. Who knows what's going to happen next?
All right. Well, make sure to follow him there on those channels. And as for myself, I'm the Ramen Schmo. You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter, Ramen Schmo. So, yeah, thanks. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And catch you guys next time. All right. Let me hit the stop recording button.